The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the fiction section of the June 17, 2002 edition of the New Yorker magazine. My Father Addresses Me on the Facts of Old Age by Grace Paley. My father had decided to teach me how to grow old. I said, okay. My children didn't think it was such a great idea. If I knew how, they thought, I might do so too easily. No, I said, it's for later, years from now. And besides, if I get it right, it might be helpful to you kids in time to come. And they said, really? My father wanted to begin as soon as possible. For God's sake, he said, you can talk to the kids later. Now, listen to me. Send them out to play. You are so distractible. We should probably begin at the beginning, he said. Change. First, there is change, which nobody likes, even men. You'd be surprised. You can do little things, putting cream on the corners of your mouth, also the heels of your feet. But here's the main thing. Oh, I wish your mother was alive. Not that she had time. But, Pa, I said, Mama never knew anything about cream. I did not say she was famous for not taking care. Forget it, he said sadly. But I must mention squinting. Don't squint. Wear your glasses. Look at your aunt, so beautiful once. I know someone has said men don't make passes at girls who wear glasses. But that's an idea for a foolish person. There are many handsome women who are not exactly 20/20. Please sit down, he said. Be patient. The main thing is this. When you get up in the morning, you must take your heart in your two hands. You must do this every morning. That's a metaphor, right? Metaphor? No. You can do this. In the morning, do a few little exercises for the joints. Not too much. Then put your hands like a cup over and under the heart, under the breast, he said tactfully. It's probably easier for a man. Then talk softly, don't yell. Under your ribs, push a little. When you wake up, you must do this massage. I mean, pat, stroke a little, don't be ashamed. Very likely, no one will be watching. Then you must talk to your heart. Talk? What? Say anything, but be respectful. Maybe say, heart, little heart, beat softly, but never forget your job, the blood. You can whisper also. Remember. For instance, I said to it yesterday, heart, do you remember my brother Grisha? How he made work for you that day when he came to the store and he said, your boss's money, Zinya, right now. How he put a gun in my face and I said, Grisha, are you crazy? Why don't you ask me at home? I would give you. We were in this America not more than 2 years. He was only a kid. And he said, who needs your workers' money? For the movement, only from your boss. Oh, little heart. You worked so hard, like a dog, like a crazy slave, bang, bang, bang that day, remember? That's the story I told my heart yesterday, my father said. What a racket it made to answer me. I remember, till I was dizzy with the thumping. Why'd you do that, Pa? I don't get it. Don't you see? This is good for the old heart. To get excited, just as good as for the person. Some people go running till late in life for the muscles, they say, but the heart knows the real purpose. The real purpose is the expansion of the arteries, a river of blood. It cleans off the banks, carries junk out of the system. I myself would rather remind the heart how frightened I was by my brother than go running in a strange neighborhood. Miles and miles, with the city so dangerous these days. I said, oh, but then I said, well, Thanks. I don't think you listened, he said. As usual, probably worried about the kids. They're not babies, you know. If you were better organized, you wouldn't have so many worries. I stopped by a couple of weeks later. This time he was annoyed. Why did you leave the kids home? If you keep doing this, they'll forget who I am. Children are like old people in that respect. They won't forget you, Pa. Never in a million years. You think so? God has not been so good about a million years. His main interest in us began, actually, he put it down in writing 5,700 years ago in the book. You know, our book, I suppose. Okay, yes. Probably a million years is too close to his lifetime, if you could call it life, what he goes through. I believe he said several times, when he was still in contact with us, I am a jealous God. Here and there he makes an exception. I read there are 3,000-year-old trees somewhere in some godforsaken place. Of course, that's how come they're still alive. We should all be so godforsaken. But no more joking around. I have been thinking what to tell you now. First of all, soon, maybe in 20, 30 years, you'll begin to get up in the morning, 4, 5 a.m. In a farmer, that's okay. But for us, you'll remember everything you did, didn't, what you omitted, whom you insulted, betrayed. That is the worst. Do you remember you didn't go to see your aunt? She was dying? That will be on your mind like a stone. Of course, I myself did not behave so well. Still, I was so busy those days, long office hours. Remember, it was usual in those days for doctors to make house calls. No elevators, fourth floor, fifth floor, even in a nice Bronx tenement. But this morning, a few hours ago, my mother, your babushka, came into my mind, looked at me. Have I told you I was arrested? Of course I did. I was arrested a few times. But this time, for some reason, the policeman walked me past the office of the local jail. My mama was there. I saw her through the window. She was bringing me a bundle of clean clothes. She put it on the officer's table. She turned. She saw me. She looked at me through the glass with such a face, eye to eye. Despair. No hope. This morning, 4 a.m., I saw once more how she sat there, very straight, her eyes. Because of that look, I did my term, my sentence, the best I could. I finished up 6 months in Arkhangelsk, where they finally sent me. Then, no more. No more, I said to myself. No more saving Imperial Russia, the great pogrom maker, from itself. Oh, Pa, don't make too much out of everything. Well, anyway, I want to tell you also how the body is your enemy. I must warn you, it is not your friend the way it was when you were a youngster. For example, greens, believe me, are overrated. Some people believe they will cure cancer. It's the style. My experience with maybe 100 patients proves otherwise. Greens are helpful to God. That fellow Sandberg, the poet, I believe from Chicago, explained it. Grass tiptoes over the whole world, holds it in place. Except the desert, of course. Everything there is loose, flying around. How come you bring up God so much? When I was a kid, you were a strict atheist. You even spit on the steps of the synagogue. Well, God is very good for conversation, he said. By the way, I believe I have to tell you a few words about the stock market. Your brother-in-law is always talking about how brilliant he is. Investing. My advice to you, stay out of it. But people are making money. A lot. Read the paper. Even kids are becoming millionaires. But what of tomorrow? He asked. Tomorrow, I said, they'll make another million. No. I mean, tomorrow. I was there when tomorrow came in 1929. So I say to them and their millions, ha, 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 tomorrow will come. Go home now. I have a great deal more to tell you. Somehow, I'm always tired. Well, I'll go in a minute, but I have to tell you something, Pa. I had to tell him that my husband and I were separating, maybe even divorce, the first in the family. What? What? Are you crazy? I don't understand you people nowadays. I married your mother when I was a boy. It's true I had a first-class mustache, but I was a kid. And you know, I stayed married till the end. Once or twice, she wanted to part company, but not me. The reason, of course, she was inclined to be jealous. He then gave me the example that I'd heard 5 or 6 times before. What it was, one time, 2 couples went to the movie, Arzimich and his wife. You remember. Well, I sat next to his wife, the lady of the couple, by the way, a very attractive woman. And during the show, which wasn't so great, we talked about this and that, laughed a couple of times. When we got home, your mother said, okay, anytime you want, right now, I'll give you a divorce. We will go our separate ways. Naturally, I said, what? Are you ridiculous? My advice to you, stick it out. It's true, your husband, he's a peculiar fellow, but think it over. Go home. Maybe you can manage at least till old age. Then, if you still don't get along, you can go to separate old age homes. Pa, it's no joke. It's my life. It is a joke. A joke is necessary at this time. But I'm tired. You'll see, in 30, 40 years from now, you'll get tired often. It doesn't mean you're sick. This is something important that I'm telling you. Listen, to live a long time, long years, you've got to sleep a certain extra percentage away. It's a shame. It was at least 3 weeks before I saw him again. He was drinking tea, eating a baked apple, one of 12 my sister baked for him every 10 days. I took another one out of the refrigerator. Father's and Son's was on the kitchen table. Most of the time he read history. He kept Gibbon and Prescott on the lampstand next to his resting chair. But this time, thinking about Russia for some reason, in a kindly way, he was reading Turgenev. You were probably pretty busy, he said. Where are the kids? With the father? He looked at me hopefully. No hope, Pa. By the way, you know, this fellow Turgenev, he wasn't a show-off. He wrote a certain book, and he became famous right away. One day he went to Paris, and in the evening he went to the opera. He stepped into his box, and just as he was sitting down, the people began to applaud. The whole opera house was clapping. He was known. Everybody knew his book. He said, I see Russia is known in France. You're a lucky girl that these books are in the living room, more on the table than on the shelf. Yes. Excuse me, also about Turgenev. I don't believe he was an anti-Semite. Of course, most of them were, even if they had brains. I don't think Gorky was. Gogol, probably. Tolstoy, no. Tolstoy had an opinion about the Mexican-American War. Did you know? Of course, most were anti-Semites. Dostoevsky, it was natural, it seems. Ah, why is it we read them with such interest and they don't return the favor? That's what women writers say about men writers. Please don't start in. I'm in the middle of telling you some things you don't know. Well, I suppose you do know a number of Gentiles. You're more in the American world. I know very few. Still, I was telling you, Jews were not allowed to travel in Russia. I told you that. But a Jewish girl, if she was a prostitute, could go anywhere throughout all Russia. Also, a Jew, if he was a merchant first class, even people with big stores were only second class. Who else? A soldier who had a medal, I think St. George. Do you know nobody could arrest him? Even if he was a Jew, if he killed someone, a policeman could not arrest him. He wore a certain hat. Why am I telling you all this? Well, it is interesting. Yes, but I'm supposed to tell you a few things, give advice, a few last words. Of course, the fact is, I am obliged because you are always getting yourself mixed up in politics. Because your mother and I were such radical kids, socialist, in constant trouble with the police. It was 1904, 1905. You have the idea it's okay for you and it's not okay in this country, which is a democracy. And you're running in the street like a fool. Your cousin saw you a few years ago in school, suspended, sitting with other children in the auditorium, not allowed to go to class. You thought Mama and I didn't know. Pa, that was 35 years ago in high school. Anyway, what about Mama? You mentioned the Arzmich family. She was a dentist, wasn't she? Right, a very capable woman. Well, Mama probably felt bad about not getting to school and, you know, becoming something, having a profession like Mrs. What's-her-name? I mean, she did run the whole house and family and the office and people coming to live with us, but she was sad about that, surely. He was quiet. And then he said, you're right. It was a shame. Everything went into me, so I should go to school. I should graduate. I should be the doctor. I should have the profession. Poor woman. She was extremely smart, at least as smart as me. In Russia, in the movement, you know, when we were youngsters, she was considered the more valuable person. Very steady, honest. Made first-class contact with the workers, a real organizer. I could be only an intellectual. But maybe if life didn't pass so quick, speedy, like a winter day, short. You know, also, she was very musical. She had perfect pitch. A few years ago, your sister made similar remarks to me about Mama, questioning me, like, history is my fault. Your brother only looked at me the way he does, not with complete approval. Then one day, my father surprised me. He said he wanted to talk a little, but not too much, about love or sex or whatever it's called, its troubling persistence. He said that might happen to me, too, eventually. It should not be such a surprise. Then, a little accusingly, after all, I have been a man alone for many years. Did you ever think about that? Maybe I suffered. Did it ever even enter your mind? You're a grown-up woman, after all. But, Pa, I wouldn't ever have thought of bringing up anything like that. You and Mama were so damn puritanical. I never heard you say the word sex till this day. Either of you. We were serious socialists, he said. So, he looked at me, raising one nice thick eyebrow. You don't understand politics too well, do you? Actually, I had thought of it now and then, his sexual aloneness. I was a grown-up woman, but I turned it into a tactful question. Aren't you sometimes lonely, Pa? I have a nice apartment. Then he closed his eyes. He rested his talking self. I decided to water the plants. He opened one eye. Take it easy. Don't overwater. Anyway, he said, only your mother, a person like her, could put up with me. Her patience. You know, I was always losing my temper. But finally, with us, everything was all right. All right. Accomplished. You understand? Your brother and sister finished college, married. We had a beautiful grandchild. I was working very hard, like a dog. We were only 50 years old then. But look, we bought the place in the country. Your sister and brother came often. You yourself were running around with a dozen kids in bathing suits all day. Your mama was planting all kinds of flowers every minute. Trees were growing. Your grandma, your babushka, sat on a good chair on the lawn. In back of her were birch trees. I put in a nice row of spruce. And then one day in the morning, she comes to me, my wife. She shows me a spot over her left breast. I know right away. I don't touch it. I see it. In my mind, I turn it this way and that. But I know in that minute, in 1 minute, everything is finished. Finished. Happiness, pleasure, finished. Years ahead, black. Now, that minute had been told to me a couple of years ago, maybe twice in 10 years. Each time it nearly stopped my heart. No. He recovered from the telling. Now, listen, this means, of course, that you should take care of yourself. I don't mean eat vegetables. I mean go to the doctor on time. Nowadays, a woman as sick as your mama could live many years. Your sister, for example, after terrible operations, heart bypass, colon cancer, more she probably hides from me. She is running around to theater, concerts, probably supports Lincoln Center. Ballet, chamber, symphony, 3-4 times a week. But you must pay attention. One good thing, don't laugh, is bananas. Really, potassium. I myself eat one every day. But seriously, I'm running out of advice. It's too late to beg you to finish school, get a couple of degrees, a decent profession. Be a little more strict with the children. They should be prepared for the future. Maybe they won't be as lucky as you. Well, no more advice. I restrain myself. Now, I'm changing the whole subject. I will ask you a favor. You have many friends, teachers, writers, intelligent people, Jews, non-Jews. These days, I think often, especially after telling you the story a couple of months ago about my brother Grisha, I want to know what happened to him. Well, I guess we know he was deported around 1922, right? Yes, yes, but why did they go after him? The last 10 years before that, he calmed down quite a bit. Had a nice job, I think. But that's what they did. Did you know? Even after the Palmer raids, that was maybe 1919, they kept deporting people. They picked them up at home at the Russian Artist Club at meetings. Of course, you weren't even around yet, maybe just born. They thought that these kids had in mind a big revolution, like in Russia. Some joke. Ignorance. Grisha and his friends didn't like Lenin from the beginning. More Bakunin, Emma Goldman, her boyfriend. I forgot his name. Berkman. Right. They were shipped, I believe, to Vladivostok. There must be a file somewhere, archives salted away. Why did they go after him? Maybe they were mostly Jews. Anti-Semitism in the American blood from Europe. A little thinner, I suppose. But why didn't we talk? All the years not talking. Me seeing sick people day and night. Strangers. And not talking to my brother till all of a sudden he's on a ship. Gone? Go home now. I don't have much more to tell you. Anyway, it's late. I have to prepare now all of my courage. Not for sleep, for waking in the early morning. Maybe 3 or 4 a.m. I have to be ready for them, my morning visitors. Your babushka, your mama, most of all. To tell the truth, it's for your aunt, my sister, the youngest. She said to me that day in the hospital, "Don't leave me here. Take me home to die." And I didn't. And her face looked at me that day, and many, many mornings looks at me still. I stood near the door holding my coat, a space at last for me to say something, my mouth open. "Enough already," he said. "I had the job to tell you how to take care of yourself, what to expect. About the heart. You know it was not a metaphor. But in the end, a great thing, a really interesting thing, would be to find out what happened to our Grisha. You're smart. You can do it. Also, You'll see, you'll be lucky in this life to have something you must do to take your mind off of all the things you didn't do. Then he said, I suppose that is something like a joke, but my dear girl, it's very serious. Next, from the November 3rd, 2025 issue of the New Yorker, why Immanuel Kant still has more to teach us. A new introduction to the great philosopher's work foregrounds its revolutionary nature and far-reaching impact by Adam Kirsch. In April 1745, God appeared to a Swedish civil servant named Emanuel Swedenborg in a London tavern. Swedenborg was no wild-eyed prophet, but rather a 57-year-old scientist and engineer who had worked for years for the Swedish crown as an administrator of mines. However, traveling around Europe while on leave, he had begun to have intense dreams about Jesus Christ, in which everyday details were shot through with mystical bliss. In one, Jesus borrowed a 5-pound note from someone, and Swedenborg recalled, I was sorry he had not borrowed it from me. Finally, God showed himself while Swedenborg was at dinner, taking the form of a man who told him not to eat too much. From that night until his death, 27 years later, Swedenborg devoted himself to conversing with spirits and angels and writing down the mystical truths that they told him. As Swedenborg's fame spread across Europe in the 1760s, he came to the attention of a junior professor of philosophy at the University of Königsberg in eastern Prussia named Immanuel Kant. Then, in his late 30s, Kant considered himself, as he wrote to a friend, free of, quote, any trace of a way of thinking inclined to the miraculous, end quote. Yet he admitted to being interested in Swedenborg, especially because the man's power of clairvoyance seemed to have been vouched for by credible witnesses. Kant had a lot in common with the Swedish mystic. He, too, was a Northern European, a Protestant, and a man of science. At a time when philosophy and natural philosophy, the scholarly pursuits that developed into today's natural sciences, were not yet entirely separate. Kant published work not only about metaphysics and ethics, but also about physics, cosmology, and earthquakes. In his first book, Thoughts on the True Estimation of Living Forces, published in 1749, Kant wondered how the human body, which is entirely material and physical, is related to the human mind, which doesn't seem to be. How is it possible for a force that produces only motions to generate representations and ideas? He asked. But if what Swedenborg wrote was true, spirit and matter might not be so divided after all. Kant ordered Swedenborg's books from London and told a friend that he was waiting for them with longing. Yet, when he eventually wrote about Swedenborg in the short book Dreams of a Spirit Seer, 1766, it was with sarcasm. The Swedish mystic, Kant now believed, was the worst of all dreamers, his books utterly empty of the last drop of reason. The real source of Swedenborg's visions, Kant joked, was bad digestion. Quote, if a wind should rage in the guts, what matters is the direction it takes. If downwards, then the result is a fart. If upwards, an apparition or a heavenly inspiration. End quote. Still, reading Swedenborg hadn't been a complete waste of time, because it led Kant to an important truth. Swedenborg had convinced himself that the spirit could, like matter, be perceived with the senses. But Kant concluded that the task of philosophy was to distinguish those two realms, to show what kinds of truths we can hope to know from experience, and what kinds we can only ever imagine or make up stories about. Metaphysics, he wrote, is the science of the boundaries of human reason. That may not exactly sound like a call to arms, but the title of an expert and engaging new introduction to the philosopher encourages us to think otherwise. Kant, A Revolution in Thinking, published by Harvard, by Marcus Vilacek, translated by Peter Lewis, argues that what made Kant revolutionary was his contention that to understand anything, science, justice, freedom, God, we first have to understand ourselves. Vilaschek, one of the world's leading authorities on Kant and the editor of the standard German edition of Kant's works, writes, Kant placed the human at the center of his thought like no other philosopher before him. As Vilaschek demonstrates, Kant believed that his ideas would change humanity's understanding of its place in the world as profoundly as the Copernican Revolution had changed our sense of Earth's place in the cosmos. And they did, for philosophy at least, igniting the most fertile period in Western thought since Plato and Aristotle. Vilaschek offers a gauge of Kant's influence by looking at the term critique, which Kant used in the titles of his three major books, The Critique of Pure Reason, 1781, The Critique of Practical Reason, 1788, and The Critique of Judgment, 1790. At the time, the word K-R-I-T-I-K, critique, was a relatively new addition to the German language, and Kant was the first to use it in a title. Today, Vilaschek writes, the catalog of the German National Library contains no fewer than 24,000 works with the word Kritik in their titles. More broadly, he observes, Kant's ideas about the mind shaped the development of psychology, anthropology, and the more recent social sciences. In the 20th century, philosophers of science grappled with Kant as they tried to make sense of the baffling discoveries of relativity and quantum physics. The American transcendentalists took their name from one of Kant's key technical terms. I apply the term transcendental, he wrote, to all knowledge which is not so much occupied with objects as with the mode of our cognition of these objects. Ralph Waldo Emerson was thus waxing Kantian when he declared, I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. The central insight that these disparate thinkers took from Kant is that the world is not simply a thing or a collection of things given to us to perceive. Rather, our minds help create the reality we experience. In particular, Kant argued that time, space, and causality, which we ordinarily take for granted as the most basic aspects of the world, are better understood as forms imposed on the world by the human mind. The parallel with Copernicus turns out to be apt. Before Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo, people assumed that the sun and the planets revolved around the earth, and justifiably so. That's how it appears to us when we look up at the sky. It took a lot of close observation and ingenious reasoning for astronomers to understand that this was a trick of perspective, and that, in fact, it is the Earth that revolves around the sun. Similarly, it is natural for human beings to assume that the way the world appears to us, extended in three dimensions, constantly moving from the past into the future, changing as its different elements interact, is the way it really is. But, Kant maintained, this is also a trick of perspective. Space and time do not exist objectively, only subjectively as forms of our experience. He wrote that it is from the human point of view only that we can speak of space, extended objects, etc. This thinking led Kant to a more pessimistic conclusion than Copernicus's. Whereas humanity did eventually arrive at a correct understanding of the solar system, it is impossible for us to ever know things in themselves, what Kant called noumena. We have access only to phenomena, the way things look to us, given the kind of mind we have. Kant insisted that what things may be in themselves, I know not and need not know, because a thing is never presented to me otherwise than as a phenomenon. This is an unsettling message, Vilaschek writes. It seems to rob all the things around us of their solidity, so to speak, and to transform them into mere figments of our imagination. In fact, Kant didn't intend to make us doubt the evidence of our senses. Instead, he reasoned, it is because all human beings experience the world through the same categories of time and space that scientific knowledge is possible. Science claims to deal with the world only as we perceive it, not as it is in itself, and to that extent it is completely reliable. Anyone who measures an object in free fall in a vacuum will find that it accelerates at 32 feet per second squared. We don't have to worry that this is a figment of our imagination. But Kant's theory of knowledge poses a serious problem for any kind of religion or philosophy that claims to tell us about ultimate truths and eternal essences, such as God. If our minds are unable to reach beyond the limits of time and space, then metaphysical knowledge is a contradiction in terms. The notion of a supreme being is in many respects a highly useful idea, Kant granted, but it is only an idea, and it is incapable of enlarging our cognition with regard to the existence of things. Is it possible to live a meaningful existence in the absence of God and other absolute truths? This would become the central question for modern Western thought, and it was Kant who first posed it in all its complexity. The answer he offered was actually more hopeful than those of many writers who came after him. He believed that it was possible to live a good and moral life while accepting the boundaries of our understanding. But he was certain that in philosophy, as in astronomy, the discovery of our deficiencies must produce a great change in the determination of the aims of human reason. Such a revolutionary ambition was fitting for a philosopher who did his most important work in the age of the American and French revolutions. Yet, in his personal life, Kant was the opposite of rebellious. Vilacek organizes his book around themes, with chapters devoted to Kant's ideas on education, revolution, wit, science, and even extraterrestrials. He believed that they must exist, rather than chronologically, mainly because Kant's biography is terrifically dull. He was born in Königsberg, now Kaliningrad, a bustling but remote port town, in 1724, and died there in 1804. Apart from a couple of teaching stints in nearby towns, he never lived anywhere else or even visited another city. He never married, saying that by the time he earned enough money to support a wife, he no longer wanted one. There is no evidence that he ever had a love affair or a sexual encounter. The central relationship of Kant's life was with the University of Königsberg, where he enrolled as a student at the age of 16 and taught for 41 years, with a few years break when he worked as a private tutor. This was an era when most professors weren't paid salaries, living instead on lecture fees from students. Unlike some of his colleagues, Kant had no family money to fall back on. His father was a poor saddle maker. So, as Vilacek writes, he lectured on logic, metaphysics, mathematics, and physics, and later supplemented these subjects with several others, physical geography, mineralogy, mechanics, general philosophy, practical philosophy, ethics, anthropology, natural law, natural theology, and pedagogy. He was far from an expert on all of these subjects, but what mattered was quantity. Kant taught for 82 consecutive semesters without a pause, initially for up to 24 hours a week, though later in his career he cut it back to 16. All of this does not mean that he was a hermit or a bore. Kant had an active social life and was known for being well-dressed. He emphasized this sociability to a younger philosopher when admonishing him for spending too much time with books. Only by being in the world was it possible to educate oneself, Kant insisted. Later in life, though, he became more withdrawn as he focused on writing. All his most important books were published after he turned 55. By 1792, when France deposed King Louis XVI and proclaimed a republic, Kant was nearly 70 and had spent decades living sedately among Königsberg's better, often aristocratic social circles. It would have made perfect sense if he had joined them in deploring the dispossession, expulsion, and murder of the French nobility, Bilicek writes. Yet he made no secret of sympathizing with the revolution, quoting what the aged Simeon said about the birth of Jesus in the Gospels. Lord, you may now dismiss your servant in peace, for my eyes have seen your salvation. For Kant, the revolution seemed to put into practice the ideal that he placed at the center of his own thought, emancipation, setting human beings free so that they could be in charge of their own lives. In 1784, after a German magazine cheekily asked if anyone could define the fashionable term enlightenment, Kant rose to the challenge with an essay that is now possibly his most widely read work, called Answer to the Question, What is Enlightenment? It begins with a simple but thrilling definition. Enlightenment is man's release from his self-incurred tutelage. Tutelage is the condition of being a minor in need of a guardian. Throughout history, Kant says, that is how most human beings have thought of themselves. Afraid to trust their own judgment, they have looked to authorities to tell them what to do. If I have a book which understands for me, a pastor who has conscience for me, a physician who decides my diet, and so forth, I need not trouble myself, Kant writes. But, at last, ordinary people were starting to realize that they have the right and the ability to think for themselves. Have courage to use your own reason. That is the motto of enlightenment, he proclaims. The goal of the French revolutionaries was liberty, but Kant's ideal was significantly different. He called it autonomy, from the Greek words for self and law. Liberty implies a lack of constraint. We are free when no one can stop us from doing what we want. Autonomy means living by rules that we choose to accept because we decide that they are reasonable. As Kant puts it, a free will is subject to the law of which it can regard itself as the author. For Kant, Vilicek writes, it is this autonomy of humans, the capacity to impose moral laws upon ourselves, that forms the basis of our special dignity. Accordingly, he formulated an entirely new definition of morality, one that has been enormously influential in the modern world, even though in some ways it is deeply counterintuitive. If you asked an ordinary European in Kant's lifetime what makes an action wrong, the answer would probably have involved God. Things like murder, theft, and adultery are wrong because they are sins prohibited by God in the Bible, and sinners are punished in this world or the next. Many people today would say the same thing. Another kind of answer focuses on consequences. An action is wrong if it causes people to suffer. This idea is rooted in basic human sympathy, but in the 19th century it would have been systematized as utilitarianism, the idea that the standard of morality is what brings the greatest benefit to the greatest number of people. Kant's understanding of right and wrong is far more abstract, having nothing to do with piety or pain. In Groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, one of his more accessible books, though he acknowledged that it had a horrifying title, he argues that actions themselves can't be described as good or evil. Those terms can be applied only to the human will, which is free to decide how to act in any situation. It is impossible to conceive anything at all in the world, or even out of it, which can be taken as good without qualification, except a good will, Kant writes. Ordinarily, we think of goodwill as a kind of emotion. A person of goodwill is happy when other people are happy. But for Kant, emotion is irrelevant to morality. In fact, he believes that if you do the right thing because it makes you happy, you don't have a truly good will because you are acting out of a kind of self-interest. The only thing that should determine how we act is a pure sense of duty. When a man does an action without any inclination for the sake of duty alone, then, for the first time, his action has its genuine moral worth, Kant writes. We owe this duty not to God or to other people, but to our own reason. Every time we face a moral choice, Kant argues, we should think as if we were lawmakers, drawing up a rule or maxim, for all of humanity to follow. If our reason approves of this maxim, then we are obligated to follow it, whether it benefits us personally or not. This is Kant's famous categorical imperative, which he considers the essence of morality. I ought never to act except in such a way that I can also will that my maxim should become a universal law. Kant offers a few examples of how this works in practice. May I not, when I am hard-pressed, make a promise with the intention of not keeping it? He asks. For instance, can I borrow money knowing that I will not be able to pay it back? One way of answering that question is to look at what would be good for me in the long term. If I default on a debt, no one will lend me money in the future, so my own self-interest tells me not to borrow on false pretenses. But to refrain from making a false promise for this reason would not be moral, Kant argues, because I would be acting solely on fear of consequences, not out of reason and duty. To act morally, I need to ask what would happen if everyone acted the way I do. And in a world where everyone makes promises that they do not intend to keep, Kant argues, there could properly be no promises at all, since no one would ever trust anyone else's word. This logical contradiction shows that when I break a promise, I am not acting like a legislator making rules for everyone to follow. What I really want is for everyone to follow the rule except for me, so that I can benefit by exploiting others' trust. Kant insists that we have a duty to follow the categorical imperative, even if it results in physical harm. In an essay from 1797, he considered a scenario in which a man allows a friend who is being pursued by a murderer to hide in his house. If the murderer comes to the door and asks where the intended victim is, does the man have a moral obligation to reveal the truth? Surprisingly, Kant says yes, not because the murderer has a right to know the truth, but because no human being ever has the right to lie. To be truthful in all declarations is a sacred, unconditional command of reason and not to be limited by any expediency, he writes. Although Kant's definition of morality is not derived from religion, it makes the same kind of demand as many faiths. It urges us to forget ourselves. Indeed, he compares this idea to the passages from Scripture in which we are commanded to love our neighbor and even our enemy. It's no coincidence that Kant ended up reformulating a religious ethic in rational terms. His work had two complementary goals, one destructive, the other constructive. In the Critique of Pure Reason, he shows that humanity cannot ever know the things we want to know most about God, free will, and the true nature of reality. But then, in the Critique of Practical Reason and the Groundwork, Kant turned to rebuilding. Reason and freedom, he argued, offer a better foundation for human life than authority and tradition. They can supply us with a sterner morality, a more just politics, and even a more peaceful international order. For Kant, putting the human at the center of his thought was, as Wilczek writes, an act of faith in our ability to live according to reason. This faith is all the more moving at a time like our own, when the ideal of human reason is under attack both politically and technologically. Wilczek is concerned mainly with the first challenge. His primary motive in writing about Kant for a general readership is to ask how he can help us defend our whole conception of liberal, rules-based democracies in the West. In Europe, and especially in Germany, Kant has long served as a symbol and patron saint of the post-war liberal order. In the 1790s, he argued for democracy, cosmopolitanism, and the settlement of international disputes through a permanent Congress of Nations instead of war. Two centuries later, the West, after destroying itself with irrational hatreds, finally seemed ready to put those ideals into practice in the form of the United Nations and the European Union. But now, the Kantian consensus seems to be crumbling. Democratic countries are embracing authoritarian leaders. Anti-immigration movements are insisting on exclusive national identities. And the Russian invasion of Ukraine brought war back to a continent that had grown used to what Kant called perpetual peace. In April 2024, Olaf Scholz, then the Chancellor of Germany, marked the philosopher's 300th birthday with a speech attacking Vladimir Putin as the arch enemy, not just of Ukraine and the West, but of Kant personally. Quote, diametrically opposed to all of his notions of human rights, freedom, autonomy, and the dignity of each and every human being, end quote. At the same time, the rise of artificial intelligence is posing a quieter, but even more profound challenge to Kantian humanism. Vilacek has less to say about Kant's scientific legacy than he does about his political legacy. But both depend on Kant's belief in the uniqueness of the human mind. Man, he wrote in the Critique of Pure Reason, is the only animal that seems to be accepted from the natural laws that govern plants and animals, because only we are capable of free thought and free will. But the advance of AI technology may soon put an end to our species' monopoly on mind. If computers can think, does that mean that they are also free moral agents worthy of dignity and rights? Or does it mean, on the contrary, that human minds were never as free as Kant believed, that we are just biological machines that flatter ourselves by thinking we are something more? And if fundamental features of the world like time and space are creations of the human mind, as Kant argued, could artificial minds inhabit entirely different realities, built on different principles that we will never fully understand? These kinds of questions are discussed in the 2022 anthology, Kant and Artificial Intelligence, in which one contributor observes, "You can easily get the impression that much of contemporary cognitive science is heavily influenced by Kant's philosophy." Of course, it is impossible to draw a straight line from the 18th century to the 21st, or to say with certainty what Kant would have thought about Ukraine or ChatGPT. As Vilacek writes, Kant does not offer any ready-made solutions to the questions of our age. But what makes a philosopher great is not that they have all the answers. It is that they help us formulate our most important questions, even ones that they could never have anticipated. Kant, Vilacek says, challenges us to critically examine them for ourselves and form our own judgment. Perhaps the Kantian idea hardest to accept today is his confidence that humanity is able to do such difficult things and wants to. And now, a poem from the November 3rd, 2025 issue, Sorry for Existing, by Patricia Lockwood. In Art Chat, Jamie was building a piece. I would offer her little scenes of awkwardness or intimacy at the closet-sized barbershop where the bald man, nearly breathing on my cheek, commented on the wave in my hair, or at the mineral shop where the air was the air of eternity, redwoods fallen to the rainforest floor, eventually to become bookends. Those moments when you feel so freshly hatched, you don't know where to put yourself, sorry for existing. Or the time I struck a huge pose at the cocktail party and then realized I was next to the PowerPoint and had to be a statue for the next 30 minutes. Jamie made a small motion at the level of her chest that was like removing every Kleenex from a box at once, and it cured illness, sorrow, not being. I could see the song, the dance. Here is a big egg. My brother-in-law sends a picture of a sculpture from Seoul. An egg has a simple form, but connotes limitless possibility. Life begins, and all things are created by delicate oscillation, felt from ovalness. Spelled like that, an egg must crack is the secret. Must be always in the process of cracking, producing feathers, newness, wings. When the wind flipped through Noguchi's catalog in the garden, it paused on 1,000 horsepower heart. It flew past misexpanding universe and came to a rest on a picture of him assembling figure in his workshop. Always and forever assembling figure in a pair of drawstring pants. Sorry for existing. Black flies landed on the backs of my ankles and bit. The egg was engraved with a human fingerprint. Long whorled and patterns flung large and small. On the endless lawn, a boy ran by with a badminton racket in one hand to pose for a foreshortened picture with the birdies and a small mesh carrier in the other. 1,000 horsepower heart is lost. Figure will never be assembled again. Littlest moment, smallest scene, the look that passed between me and his mother when I saw it was a living thing. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.